Good morning.
We are continuing in a series that we're calling A New Reality. We're looking through the Gospel of John. We resumed last week after it was a bit of a hiatus. So going back into the fall, we started in this book of John to see John's perspective of Jesus' ministry. And one of the big things that John helps us understand is that Jesus spent a lot of time pointing to big realities. Big things that people didn't quite get. The things that he said, the way that he interacted and loved people, even his miracles, were all designed to point people toward a reality that was bigger than they could comprehend at that moment. Now, even Jesus, did have some difficulties doing this. And the reason he had these difficulties had nothing to do with him. It was all straight in his mind. It has to do with us. We're humans. And as humans, we're kind of boxed into a language set. We have to communicate using language. And we use words that describe experiences that are familiar to us. This probably makes sense when you think about words that have recently come up in the last couple years. For instance, I can say that I tweeted something yesterday that has nothing to do with making a bird noise, right? Or I could have Googled something, and you know that that is me going on to the Google search engine just to look for something. I can say that I MapQuested my direction somewhere, and you're looking at me like, who still uses MapQuest? But nonetheless, I still say that. I get in trouble for it, because I have converted. I still say MapQuest. I don't know. Other times, there are words that we know sort of the surface definition of, but as we really look into that word and pry into its meanings and connotations, it just gets deeper and more profound, more mysterious. Words like marriage. Yeah. You can go ahead and turn your Bibles to John chapter 13. That's where we're going to be today, John chapter 13 and John chapter 14. Jesus is going to be speaking to his disciples in what is sort of his last opportunity to help them understand a lot of really important things about who Jesus is and what he came to do. In many ways, I view chapters 13 through 17 really as a gift that was given to the church. See, in a lot of other places in Scripture, when we see what Jesus said and how he talked to religious leaders and the people around him, we oftentimes have to do a little bit of cultural unpacking because Jesus was speaking to a very specific group in a specific time who had a different cultural understanding than we do. And so we do that. That's good biblical scholarship, is to look at what was Jesus actually saying to the culture. But in John chapters 13 through 17, he's really speaking to his disciples and what will be the future church. And so there's just a lot less cultural issues that we have to sort through in order to really get at what Jesus is saying. It's complicated for entirely different reasons. He's trying to give us very clear but very difficult teachings. And so in that, we find some confusion occasionally. Now, I want us to jump toward the end of the section that we're looking at today. We're going to start in 13:31, but I want to jump to verse 12 of chapter 14, because this verse should rightfully give us some pause. Jesus speaking, "Very truly I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the works I have been doing, and they will do even greater things than these, because I am going to the Father." This verse should cause us to stop for a second, because it seems entirely implausible that we would do works greater than Jesus. I mean, this is the guy who just two chapters ago raised a dude from the dead. I don't think I, nor the disciples at the time, expect that that is something I'm going to be doing frequently. And so what does Jesus mean? How can we do things that are greater than what Jesus did on earth? It's Jesus we're talking about. But I do think that there's some ways that we can begin to understand this. But to do it, we have to understand a few things. We have to understand who Jesus is and what he came to do. And once we start to understand that, this passage will make a little bit more sense. So go ahead and jump back to verse 31. We're going to look at today's passages through the lens of a couple disciples. Disciples who, as Jesus was talking, they had some kind of a problem or an issue with what he was saying, and they needed further clarification. So we're going to go disciple by disciple. We've got Peter, Thomas, and Philip this morning, and kind of see what their concerns were, what their roadblocks were, and understanding what Jesus was talking about. Peter is one of my favorite disciples. He really does love to just throw himself into situations. And he's the kind of guy who, when Jesus walked on water, he wanted to walk on water right next to him. But he's going to get stuck on a couple things. Now, verse 31 is going to directly follow something we actually didn't get to last week, and that's this. Judas, one of the 12 disciples, has been pressed upon his heart to betray Jesus. And so you get this narrative in a couple of verses prior to verse 31. Judas has just left the room. And the disciples don't really understand what is going on. Jesus knows, but the disciples are still trying to figure it out. All they know is now Judas, who's been with them all this time, has now just left. And things are going to get really strange. And Jesus knows that Judas is leaving to go set up the betrayal was the last piece. The piece that would cause all of these events to go into motion that would lead to Jesus' arrest, his death, and ultimately his resurrection. These things were coming. They were imminent. They were hours away. They were going to happen soon. And so Jesus is going to say this to his disciples. Now, when Judas, was gone, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself, and will glorify him at once." Hopefully that's clear to you. I don't think it has to be. I think Jesus was marking this moment because now everything was in place. The table was set. The cards were dealt. This was going to happen. And Jesus knew that this moment had been preordained by God and that this was an incredible thing that was about to occur. And so Jesus is speaking in language that identifies the glory of what would happen and identifies the very unique relationship that Jesus has with the Father. And these things together will create the turning point in human history. But I really don't think the disciples caught any of that. Jesus, instead, is going to speak to them a little bit more plainly. "My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come." Jesus knew that his departure was going to mean that he'd have to separate himself from the disciples for a while. So with one last opportunity to give the disciples some really important instructions, he says this, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know you are my disciples, if you love one another." Jesus hits this three times in a very short period. Love one another. This is how the world will know who you are, what you believe, what you stand for, the realities that you point to. If you love one another, people are going to be drawn to that. It's going to change the world. So in Jesus' absence, the disciples' primary command was love one another. And this is profound, should shape the way the disciples would interact with each other in the future. And in this moment, especially after saying something three times, the disciples should begin to reflect and process what this might mean. They were used to Jesus saying things multiple times. Later, Peter would actually be told something three times. Jesus would ask him a question, "Do you love me?" And it would hit him hard because that third time, that just really punctuates the statement. This is really important. And Peter's going to completely ignore it. All right, verse 36. Simon Peter asks him, "Lord, where are you going?" He's stuck back on verse 33. Back in verse 33, Jesus said that he was going and Peter couldn't follow, and Peter's not having it. So he's missed everything that was happening in verses 34 and 35. Some of the most crucial instructions Jesus wanted to give to his disciples, and Peter's oblivious to it. Because Peter, like us, first and foremost, is kind of focused on his own story. My dad's an HR guy, and he tells me that, you know, whenever there's a big shakeup in a corporation, the first question people ask themselves is, what does this mean for me? So if you've got a 1,000-person company and you know that you need to cut about 200 jobs in order to make your budget meet, the first thought of all your employees hearing this is not, "Oh, I'm so glad my company is being fiscally responsible." The first thought is, "Am I going to lose my job? Or even if I stay here, what is my new job going to look like without all this extra help? Or if there's a boss change and now I've got to interact with someone new or a different coworker, how does this impact me?" Is the fundamental question we ask ourselves first before anything else. And this, I think, is what is happening to Peter. He's first and foremost wondering, what does this mean for me? If Jesus is going to go disappear somewhere, what am I left with? Jesus replied, "Where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later." Peter asks, Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. And I really do believe that Peter is sincere in this moment. He really thinks that when push came to shove, that he would give his life for Jesus. Now, there's two problems with this, though. One, this wasn't what Jesus was asking of him at this point in time. Peter could die. He could die a martyr. But those were all very human things. Jesus could do something bigger. The other issue, too, is that Peter, in his blindness, would not realize that he was much weaker than he thought. In fact, the situation would occur where his weakness would be made known. In verse 38, Jesus answered, will you really lay down your life for me? Very truly, I tell you, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. And we'll get there later in the series, but this is exactly what will happen to Peter, that in the crucial moment, he denies Jesus. For all of his good intentions, when his own story is threatened, he doesn't respond well. What Peter is missing is that his story is just a small part of something that is much bigger than what any human can do. And so Peter has to learn this lesson ultimately, that Jesus has come to do something bigger than what is humanly possible. Jesus has come to do something bigger than what is humanly possible. Jesus would be the one to die. And he would be the one to die because he is the one who could conquer sin and death. This is outside of what any human could accomplish. Now, Peter and the other disciples, they would get to play a part in this big story, but it wasn't about them or what they could do. This was about what Jesus could do, which was far greater. And Peter, in this sort of narrow-minded approach of how this affected him and his life, was missing out on the grandness of what would occur. But Peter wasn't going to be the only one who's going to be baffled by this. Thomas is also going to have some concerns. Now, Thomas is a disciple that you might have heard of before. Sometimes we call him Doubting Thomas. We call him Doubting Thomas because later on he'll need to see the scars of Jesus in order to really believe that he rose from the dead. But we have to understand about Thomas that he is actually very, very faithful, that he will follow Jesus wherever Jesus goes. This actually happened in the Lazarus event. Thomas was certain, along with the other disciples, that if they went back, that they would be killed. And he wasn't entirely wrong. Jesus would ultimately be arrested and killed. But Thomas, at the end of that, said, well, let us go, that we might also die with him. Thomas wants to follow Jesus and will follow Jesus, but Thomas has one big issue. He kind of needs to see the road to get there. So Jesus is going to say some things partly to help Peter out here. He says, do not let your hearts be troubled. You believed in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going. Hopefully, at this point in time, Peter's reassured that this is not the end, that Jesus is going to come back. But as Jesus is saying this, Thomas is baffled. He's baffled partly because of this last statement when Jesus says, you know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas is racking his brain and he comes to the conclusion, I have no clue. I don't know. Not only do I not know how, I don't know where. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way? Thomas is someone I relate to a lot. It's one of my personality quirks. We just did a personality profile with the staff. I'm definitely one of those guys who, when you kind of break it down, I have to know the how. There's visionaries who can see the what. That's great. I'm the guy who needs to know the how before I'll even talk about the what. I need to know how we're going to get there, what steps we're going to take, if it's even possible. If there's logistical issues, I can be the first one to kind of bust someone's bubble. That's sort of the way that my personality works. And I think Thomas is a little bit like this. He needs to know the how. He needs the details. He has to be able to see all of the steps that are going to be taken to the destination. And Jesus is telling them something that doesn't make sense to him. And so Thomas, I don't think that this is really a lack of faith thing. This is so much more of a kind of scenario where he just really wants to understand. He wants to get it. He wants to understand how he's going to get to where Jesus is because he wants to be there. But he's missing something very crucial. Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Thomas was looking for the steps. And Jesus would tell him, the route you're looking to take is me. Jesus is the way. Jesus is the truth. And Jesus is the life. I don't know if Thomas was wholly satisfied by this answer. I do know that our world is not wholly satisfied by this answer, because there is a very difficult truth embedded in this verse. In this verse, a lot of people know John 3:16. I'd say this is probably the second most well-known verse in the book of John. A lot of people have trouble with this because there is a truth here that is hard to absorb, hard to fully step into. It's this. Jesus is the way. Jesus is the way to God, to the kingdom. It's Jesus. This is different, by the way, from someone who shows the way. Actually, our culture doesn't have really any problem with Jesus being someone who shows a way to God. That's fine, because they're happy to learn from his teachings. Jesus teaches us to love others well. He gives us insights about what it means to be human. These are all things that we could learn from. Among, by the way, many other fantastic individuals, other leaders of other religions, philosophers, politicians, thinkers, people who have inspired us. And yes, it is fantastic. We want to learn from these wise people that tell us and show us how we can love others better and live life to its fullest. There's a lot of voices out there that can help us with that. And every one of them is worth hearing and noting and trying to figure out how it is that we can do this thing called life. It's great. But there's something fundamentally different about Jesus, because Jesus does not show the way. If I wanted to get to LAX, there's a number of different things that could show me the way. I could MapQuest it. I could ask one of you who knows how to get there. I could hail a taxi, and the taxi driver can tell me how to get there and probably even shuttle me over, but the way is different. Jesus is the way. He's not showing us the way. He is the way. And when we see Jesus, when we participate in life with him, when we have a relationship with him, then we begin to experience this path that leads us toward God and what he is doing in the world around us now and forever. This is the bold claim of Christianity, because it kind of requires us to put all of our eggs in one basket, all of our chips on one hand, because there is only one way, and that is Jesus. And so while there's a lot we can learn from other people to participate with God in the ever-moving reality of the kingdom of heaven, that's Jesus. That's where we go. And I know that this is hard. And for some of you who maybe are just kind of exploring Christianity, this is probably one of the things that makes it really hard for you to jump into this, because it sounds sort of narrow, almost sounds offensive in this world, and that's understandable. But it's because of who Jesus is. Jesus is the way. And Thomas, I think throughout the rest of his life, will really begin to understand that. That in choosing to follow Jesus, that it would bring him into what God is doing in the world, and he would begin to experience God's movement. And it would change the life of the disciples, it would change the life of the church, and really, it would change history. There's one more disciple who had a little bit of a hard time with this. His name is Philip. Now, Philip, I kind of think, probably caught some of the same issues that some of the Jews and the religious leaders caught in the earlier chapters in John. Although he wanted to follow Jesus, there were just some expectations he had about what following Jesus would mean. And so when he was looking at someone like Jesus, he was trying to figure out, what is God really like? And in his mind, he had a very narrow conception of what God is like, and Jesus still didn't quite fit the bill for him. Verse 7, Jesus says, if you really know me, you will know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. Philip said, Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us. Philip was missing it. Jesus answered, don't you know me, Philip, even after I have been among you such a long time? Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves. In these verses, Jesus is trying to help Philip understand the very incredible but difficult to attain reality that Jesus is God. That when Philip and the rest of the disciples encounter Jesus, they are encountering God. God just didn't look like probably what they were expecting. A couple months ago, I used the example of Luke going to Dagobah to try and find this Jedi master called Yoda, and encounters this little green guy that's irritating him and completely misses that the little green guy was Yoda. He had the wrong expectations. I think that Philip and many others, including the disciples, just had expectations of what God was like, and it was causing them to miss what was right there in front of them. That if they would just open their minds a little bit to a different concept, they could see that they were having an encounter with the living God as they were walking and living life with Jesus. An incredible opportunity that just didn't make sense to them at the time. It would make more sense to them later, but there they were missing it. Now this one is hard for us to get as well. It's hard because, again, we don't really have experience with this. We don't have a concept for a man to also be God. That's outside of our experience, and so language is always going to fall short a little bit when we get to this point. And so even Jesus' language couldn't quite get Philip to understand all of it. It's this profound mystery that we step into, even acknowledging that we do not fully comprehend it all of the time. And that's actually okay. Jesus says this to Philip back at the end of verse 11, "Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves." It's kind of like he gives Philip an out. I recognize that this might be beyond what you can actually comprehend, and that's all right. But you've been doing life with me for this whole time. You have seen things that you know that you can't explain, things that pointed you to God. Let those things carry you forward. And even when the understanding isn't perfect, let this life that we've lived together take you one step further, one action further into a deeper faith, deeper understanding, and deeper love. And as you do that and encounter more questions that you might not have perfect answers to, again, fall back on what we've been doing together and take one more step of deeper faith, deeper understanding, and deeper love. The disciples would do that. And I know for myself that I need this too. Because even as someone who's spent some time in a formal academic setting trying to understand God and trying to understand who he is and how Jesus is part of God, it's still a mystery that's outside my experience. And because of that, I need to keep taking steps in faith to allow God to help me understand the fullness of who he is more and more each day. It's not something I'm just going to click into. It's not something I'm even going to find the right word for. We've invented words to describe it, but still outside of our experience. But God, who's been with us, taking us up into this life with him, we get to perpetually live with him, perpetually move forward in relationship. And as we do that, that life experience, that time with God, can propel us forward into new territories that we didn't even know we could journey into. And that's an incredible thing. These three disciples came to understand three truths, or at least were confronted with three truths, even if they couldn't understand them. One was that Jesus had come to do something bigger than what was humanly possible. This was Peter's issue, because he was stuck in his own story, but Jesus was coming to do something bigger than Peter could ever possibly comprehend. Thomas, he needed the how, but the real issue there is that Jesus is the way, and that following Jesus, being in relationship with Jesus, is how he would find what God was up to and be part of that. And finally, Jesus is God. An understanding of who Jesus is that fundamentally changes what he came to do, because as God, he could do things that humans simply could not do. Now later, New Testament figures would try to find other ways to articulate this. Paul, for instance, he references this language in Philippians 2. "Your relationships with one another have the same mindset as Christ, who, being in very nature God, rather, he made himself nothing." This is sort of a truncated version of this verse. But he would go on to say that he made himself like a servant, taking human form. The one who is in very nature God did not consider equality with God something to be grasped or had. It's difficult language. It's hard to get our minds around. It's baffling in many ways. But it's a profound truth of a God who's profoundly bigger than we are. And it's that truth that carries us in to the answer to our question. How is it that we can do miracles greater than Jesus? All right, work with me for a second. The miracles Jesus did were never about the miracles themselves. That's what we've been looking at since the fall. Jesus didn't do miracles just because he could. He did miracles to point people toward deeper realities. He used miracles sort of as a version of language that went beyond words, because sometimes his miracles and the way he interacted with people could speak more loudly than anything he could actually say. These were all to point toward this very deep reality of who Jesus was and who God is. The disciples would carry on this work. They would do miracles. They would live life the way that Jesus lived life. And people would see that, and they would note it. What was going to be different, however, is that when the disciples did these things, from here on out, they were going to be pointing to an even more incredible reality than Jesus could have pointed to earlier in his ministry. And the reason for that is found at the end of the verse. Because I am going to the Father. Jesus knew that in the coming evenings, the events that would take place, his death, his resurrection, his ultimate ascension back into heaven, and the coming of the Holy Spirit upon the disciples and the church, these things were the profound, earth-shattering realities that would change the entire course of history in the world. That these would be the fulfillment of what God was doing and who God is and who Jesus is in God. And when the disciples did these things, they point to something much more incredible than even what Jesus was doing early in his ministry. There's other ways to read this passage. It is true that the disciples would ultimately do more things than Jesus did because there were just more of them. I don't really think it's simply because they would do more incredible miracles. You can't really talk raising someone from the dead. But they would point to this new reality. They would help people understand that the way that they viewed the world was incomplete, that something much deeper and more profound had happened in the death, resurrection of Jesus. Because in that moment, Jesus would conquer sin and death. And that would turn everything on its head. This is sort of a fun example because I can do this culturally now and not be a total geek. We'll do another Star Wars reference. Obi-Wan Kenobi, episode 4, the first Star Wars movie that was ever made, gets locked into a lightsaber battle with Darth Vader. And he tells Darth Vader, if you strike me down, I will become more powerful than you could imagine. And Darth Vader didn't really believe him. And Obi-Wan Kenobi could say that because he knew who he was. He knew what would happen, more or less, if he was to die. But as he's having this lightsaber battle with Darth Vader, they kind of come across this little wall that's actually made entirely out of glass. Right at that moment, Luke and Han and Leia and the droids are all rushing to the Millennium Falcon on the other side of this glass, and Luke makes eye contact with Obi-Wan Kenobi on the other side. And Luke is horrified because as far as he knows, Obi-Wan Kenobi is really the only hope the galaxy has. And so if something were to happen to Obi-Wan, kind of everything was lost. And so Luke, staring at Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader, sees this happening, freezes, and Obi-Wan, in the middle of this battle, makes a very subtle glance and locks eyes with Luke just for a minute. And if you go back and watch the scene, Obi-Wan Kenobi makes this most incredible little smirk. This little side smirk, just the left side of his mouth, that's it. And he holds his lightsaber up like this, out of defensive position, and Darth Vader strikes him down. Luke can't comprehend this, goes nuts, has to be dragged aboard the Millennium Falcon. But ultimately, that event would allow Obi-Wan Kenobi to sort of help Luke in the most crucial moment where Luke could actually take down the Death Star. Now, understand, Obi-Wan Kenobi is a fictional character. Even in his fictional world, his powers were limited. They were more than the average human, but they were not the kind of things that were going to conquer sin and death. The story that we're talking about is of much more incredible proportions. Because Jesus is God, he can do things that we cannot. And he can confront death head on, allow it to fully consume him, and emerge victorious. That is something only Jesus could do. And Jesus could only do it because he is the way and he is God. And that's what changes everything for us. The disciples would later carry on this work, and they would hold to these verses that follow verse 12. And I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. You may ask me for anything in my name, and I will do it. which you can't really interpret this to be like, please help me win the next big lottery jackpot. That's not exactly what's going on here. These were disciples who were following Jesus. They knew what Jesus was about. They knew what Jesus was trying to do in the world, and they wanted to be part of it. And as they would go forward after the next couple of evenings, as they would eventually be empowered by the Spirit, they would do incredible things. And that legacy is what the church continues to do this day through the way that we interact with the world. Very much still empowered by the Spirit. The Spirit is another complicated topic. We're going to talk about that one next week, so come back next week. But we do know that God is on the move. That Jesus is more than we could ever fully grasp, but it's that mystery that draws us in. And through that, like Peter, Thomas, and Philip all eventually would, we can begin to live our lives in such a way that we point people toward the glory that is God and the reality of Jesus crucified, resurrected, and conquering sin and death. Let's pray together.